Welcome. My name is Lynn Griffin, and I am a local family and school counselor. I work internationally and nationally on family issues within families and schools. I'm also a novelist, and I write short stories. And I was asked by the Boston Book Festival to moderate this panel, and I couldn't be more thrilled to share with you these wonderful books. What I plan to do is to tell you a little bit about each person who is on our panel, and then I'll ask a specific question of each author, and then we'll engage in a conversation about some of the themes that tie the works together. And then we'll open it to questions from you, and I do hope that at the end of this discussion, you will feel very compelled to visit the independent bookstore in the hallway and purchase these wonderful books. So I'm going to start with Kate Walbert, who is the author of 6 works of fiction, including novels, and some of the stories in She Was Like That have appeared in The New Yorker, The Paris Review, Best American Short Stories, and O. Henry Prize Stories. The National Book Foundation says, like a master sorcerer, Walbert surprises us constantly with revelations and bedrock spiritual truths, hard to ignore verities about regret, loss, struggle, and endurance. Welcome, Kate.
Thank you.
Next to her is Linda Bostrom Knausgård. She is the author and a poet. Welcome to America is her 2nd novel, and it has been awarded the prestigious Swedish August Prize and nominated for the Svenska Dagbladet Literary Prize. Her translator has said of Welcome to America that its high-tension prose crackles with electricity. Strobe-like, her sentences illuminate the shadow lands of grief and insecurity as she sensitively probes the emotions of childhood vulnerability, loneliness, and longing. Welcome, Linda.
Thank you so much, and thanks this festival for the invitation.
Yeah. Happy to have you. And then we have Helen Phillips. She's the author of 5 books, including an award-winning short story collection. The Need is a New York Times Editor's Choice, an Indie Next List pick, and it's been nominated for the National Book Award. Emily St. John Mandel says that The Need is an extraordinary and dazzling original work from one of our most gifted and interesting writers. Welcome to Helen.
Thank you.
What I'd like to do, as I said, is ask each writer a question about their particular work. And I wonder if we could each start with you giving us a sentence or two about the way you like to describe your work, and then one of the themes of motherhood that you either touched intentionally or unintentionally. We'll start with you, Kate.
Oh, okay. Well, this is a collection of short fiction. She Was Like That. And in terms of theme, I mean, one of the things is that when I write, I never set out with a particular intention, although I find that with my work, I'm always circling back to women and women's lives. So I would say that a theme here is that there are not many men in the book. In fact, I think most of the men have been banished from the book. And it's really a focus on women and women's lives. But because I don't set out, even with short stories and not even with novels, for me, the writing process is really one of mystery. And so I might start with a particular detail or a fragment of a sentence, something I overheard, and then I'm learning as I write the story or as I write the novel. So
Great. That's
the way I approach it.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
How about you, Linda? How would you describe Welcome to America?
My method is much like yours. I don't have anything from the beginning, and I just follow the language. And this time in Welcome to America, I think it's a novel about love, longing, and it's a family drama, almost a chamber play, I think. Yes. So about this book, this girl Ellen that has stopped speaking and her family.
Great. Excellent. Okay.
So my book is The Need, and while I was working on it, I described it somewhat glibly as a sci-fi thriller about motherhood. Someone at an event recently described it as an existential thriller with a lot of breast milk. So it's part psychological drama, it's part speculative fiction, it has the momentum of a thriller. Those were all the things I was going for. It begins with a woman who's home alone with her two young children, and she thinks she hears an intruder in the other room, and the story goes downhill from there. But in terms of the themes I was trying to explore, those come from a pretty personal, from a very personal place, which is that when my own daughter, who is here in the front row, who has joined me today, was about 8 weeks old, my older sister died. And so right as I was having the abundance and joy of having a new child, I was also having the grief and watching my parents have the grief of losing a child. So this idea that motherhood can put you in a lot of different places of abundance and loss, those were the things that I was thinking about. The book isn't by no means a memoir, but emotionally and thematically, that was the grounding.
That's really interesting to me, because my first question for you mm-hmm. had to do with the theme of identity confusion in the novel. I really saw that as a person who works with women who really do feel, in a way, split mm-hmm. by those roles and by the experience. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to just read a little bit and then ask you a question about that.
Okay.
You write, "This problem of hers had begun about 4 years ago, since soon after Viv's birth. She confessed it only to David, wanting to know if he ever experienced the same sensation, trying and failing to capture it in words, the minor disorientations that sometimes plagued her, the small errors of eyes and ears, the conviction that the rumble underfoot was due to an earthquake rather than a garbage truck, the conviction that there was something somehow off about a piece of litter found amid the fossils in the pit at work, a brief flash or dizziness that for a millisecond caused reality to shimmer or waver or disintegrate slightly." So you really did evoke this sort of all-consuming, overwhelming parenting of a young child or two young children. Mm-hmm. And then it sort of feels like, to me, a fever dream. You know, the family gets sick, and as women, we know that when the family gets sick and the mother goes down, then what, right?
Yes.
So it felt like Molly was split into two people, literally and mm-hmm. figuratively. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that idea of coming apart at the seams mm-hmm. or feeling split.
Yes. Well, as I said, part of the genesis for the book was contemplating mothers in very different states of being, one mother who is in a state of plenty and one mother who is in a state of grief. So there's that split identity, which is at the core of the book. And then there is also a split identity, which is played out very clearly in the early chapters of the book, where it's cutting between scenes at home and scenes at work. And Molly is really navigating those two identities, and she has crises arising in both that are kind of reflecting off of each other. And I think that since the book has been published, a lot of women have written to me and said, "You have evoked very well what I have felt like in my heart and didn't know how to articulate about what it feels like to have these different sets of responsibilities." And I really wanted the book to evoke the joy of that, because there is so much joy in it, and the exhaustion, the fatigue, and the dread, because when you love something, that comes hand in hand with the fear of losing it.
Absolutely. So. And that's done so beautifully. Kate, you touch on female friendship and sometimes its connection to motherhood, which I thought was really interesting, in three separate stories. I'm just going to read little snippets. Mm-hmm. From a story called Blue Hour, Catherine says, "We moved here 17 months ago, and the boys think it's great, and Rick plays golf, and I am bored out of my mind. Rochester, for God's sake. Who would have thought I would end up here? I am the daughter of missionaries. I grew up everywhere, including Calcutta and Beijing, and I am the first to tell you life is elsewhere. My mother ran away to find it. Do you know what I mean?" And in Playdate, Liz imagines herself in a diorama. "What you might see at the American Museum of Natural History, early 21st century, NYC, USA. They're dead, actually stuffed mammals, the old woman on some sort of moving track. And what of Fran in the kitchen, or Liz in the living room, urban suburban women circa 2007, participating in on playdate, an urban suburban ritual intended to alleviate boredom, loneliness, among children, women, while encouraging, controlling social engagement. And in conversations, Dorothy thinks they are all of them staring. She sits in a ring of unfamiliar women, and they are all of them staring at her, waiting for her to say what. She is unused to this, unused to being watched, or rather seen. So I love that in the past stories, the Dorothy story, which is set in the past, mm-hmm. and then the two contemporary stories, that women are still having a lot of trouble talking about their anxiety and their pressure and where they fit in the world, where they fit in society. And I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about why you set past and present to sort of juxtapose that, or if that was an intention.
It wasn't exactly an intention. Again, following these characters, I sort of feel like I'm watching from the outside, like I'm doing the watching and wondering, what are they going to do next? What are they going to say next? How are they going to connect? And it's the famous E.M. Forrester, only connect. I feel as if in those three instances in the stories, I got to a place where the women very much want to connect, but they're kind of talking sideways at one another. And I actually think, it's funny, when I've done a fair amount of teaching, and one of the things that we talk about in class a lot is dialogue, and how when you write dialogue where one character is saying something and the other character is responding, and then the other character is responding, that it's actually not how, if you eavesdrop, people really speak to one another. That actually, when people speak to one another, usually they're going sideways. So I think that I have a tendency with my dialogue to always do that. But then when I have these women in the room, they particularly do that. And the last one that you referenced was from the story called Conversation, in which it takes place in the past, but it's supposed to be a consciousness-raising session. So the women have come together deliberately to try to hear one another. And I've never attended a consciousness-raising session. I was just imagining that and imagining how the women in the room are there for a purpose, and how sometimes even when you're somewhere for that purpose, as much as you want to achieve it, the difficulty of that connection. So I think that's where those examples come from.
I don't want to give anything away, but in that particular story, I found it interesting that some of the women came to basically unload, and there was nothing going to get in their way from unloading. And there were other women that revealed things that were surprises to themselves. And I thought, how interesting and true it is that sometimes we go into these connections with an agenda, and other times we don't, and yet there are still surprises to be had.
Things that come out, yeah. Right, exactly. Well, out of the silence, I think Silence is very interesting to play around with in fiction, and I guess it kind of comes back to the idea of how do you write dialogue. I think when you, as the writer, aren't convinced you know what the characters are going to say to one another, it's almost like you're sitting in that silence too, and that the characters end up surprising you in a way that kind of speaks to how fiction can sometimes say things that we haven't, even as the writers, thought of, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. In Helen and Kate's book, we get a lot of women, mothers' connection and their experiences and worries and concerns about children, and we're going to keep talking about that. But it's interesting because in Linda's book, we're actually hearing a perspective that's coming from the child about her mother's experience. So I want to read a little bit from Welcome to America. Ellen says, "Darkness was everywhere. The darkness smelled. It smelled of fright and something sickly. Darkness it was that rushed from the tap and filled up the bath. I washed my hair in darkness, my body, my entire being. I ate of the darkness and was stained by it inside. The darkness encroached. Only Mum still contained the light. And later she says, she was everything to me. Without her, I couldn't exist. I knew that. And later still she says, the terror I felt if she didn't come straight home after the show, my crying if it got late, where was she? What had happened? Your novel is narrated by 11-year-old Ellen, a child who refuses to speak after her father dies, and she feels as if she's in some way to blame for that loss because she had wished at one point that he had died. And her mother is portrayed as bright and vivacious and accomplished and capable, but she's also in some ways distant from Ellen, and Ellen's responding to that connection. Can you talk to us a little bit about how we get the experience of motherhood, but we get it through the child in your book?
Yeah, absolutely. It was the mother in the book, I think, is, as you told just before, someone who is absolutely busy all the time, optimistic person, really optimistic in down to her bones. Yes. And her daughter is opposite, quite opposite. So she chooses this silence and this darkness, and it's always a question about who is stronger in this novel. Is it the mother who is stronger? Is it the girl who is stronger? They measure each other out throughout this book, I think. And the brother, of course, he is a powerful figure as well.
And he's almost both.
He is? Right?
He's almost both, sometimes feeling the darkness and other times looking for the light. He seems to go back,
yes,
and forth between the,
yes,
two.
Yes, absolutely. He has that capability,
yes,
of walking.
Walking
but
the line.
But he's also Ellen in this book is really afraid of him.
Mm-hmm.
So she has a lot of things to keep together. And she sort of makes the most of the space she has, I think.
Right. And I think even though she's grieving really deeply,
yeah,
she's constantly looking to the mother's light. So she's, yes, constantly saying, we are a family of light, as if it's a mantra.
The mother, yes.
You know, to hold on to.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, so that's really fascinating. And to expand this topic about this mother-child relationship to all of the authors, Kate, in your story, Esperanza, you write, the mother is trying to be quiet as a mouse, baby can see. This is not her mother's nature. Her mother sees her noticing and smiles. Her hands in a jumble of wildflowers, her scarf bright. She has put on fresh lipstick just that morning, or perhaps in the car, in the rearview mirror, before getting out and locking the door, before walking in with the quick steps baby always heard before any others, the quick steps of a mother, the click-clack of mother, the voice of mother. Baby says she wishes she had never been born. And then Helen, in your novel, you write, the umbilical cord runs in both directions. The mother keeps the children alive, and the children keep the mother alive. So I'd love for each of you to think about this again. Do you see in each of the books, we've got this connection, this idea. And I wonder if we could talk a little bit about how our culture deals with this umbilical cord that runs in both directions, talking about mother's impact on children and children's impact on parents. We don't talk about that as much. Thoughts? Why is literature a great place to explore that?
Are you guys there are a lot of questions in there. But I think that one thing that was, to give a very concrete answer, one thing that was really interesting to me when I began breastfeeding is that there was so much about lactation that I didn't know, because I feel like it's not represented in popular culture. It's not something we talk about very often. But you need the child to take the milk out of you because you hurt if they don't.
Yeah.
And that was so interesting because, of course, everybody knows, you know, milk is the first thing that every human consumes. That's very interesting. The first need, my book is called The Need, the first need that you have as a human being is that need for milk once you exit the womb. But also, at the same time, the biological mother also needs, her first need at that moment is to have the milk taken out of her. So that kind of symbiosis of the mother-child relationship was so concrete and instinctual at that time and so fascinating to me. Like, you think that the baby is vulnerable and needs to be cared for, but the mother is vulnerable to the child as well. And I was really trying to write about that vulnerability that Molly has that that I also saw in my own mother when she lost her child. You know, just that when you have a child, it's the cliche that you then permit your heart to go walking around the world, but there is a reason that is a cliche. I mean, I actually think that's a very good description of what it feels like. And the fact that people do this all the time is pretty amazing to me. It's and really amazing.
Absolutely. And that it's fraught with a lot of anxiety and pressure because of that feeling. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it doesn't change based on how old your children are. I mean, I have adult children and it doesn't stop. It's still that feeling, you know? Do either of you have thoughts?
Yeah, because the mother is, you can always feel like a mother to children, that you are so extremely important. And then you got scared for many, many things, I think. What if something's happening to me or some... I mean, you have all these really strong feeling. And, yeah. And the mothers, how much we even say or wish to take them away, we cannot do that. We are so affected by right. our mothers.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. How about you, thoughts, Kate?
Well, I think with what Helen was talking about, the kind of the symbiosis and the back and forth, and also Linda's comment about the terror. I mean, that's one of the things that I think... you know, no one prepares you for, they can't prepare you for. Mm-hmm. The description from Esperanza, the story, and that was inspired by someone telling me about how they had many, many, many miscarriages and that they almost had another one, but that they were traveling and they were in South America, somewhere in the middle of nowhere, and she was about to have another miscarriage, but somehow this doctor, this miracle worker, came in and gave her an injection of a hormone, and she was able to save her child, her pregnancy. And that was something that someone mentioned to me probably, I don't know how many years ago, but, you know, we're all magpies, I think. You just gather all this evidence from everywhere. Yeah. And I found myself imagining my way into that story and thinking, well, what would that be? Because she was telling me this, and her child was in her 30s, and that still was the story she had to tell, you know. So it was creating a child and yet at the same time saving the child. I thought that was really interesting. Mm.
And then in your story, baby grows up to have her own challenges with her life and says, I wish I had never been born, which is just
right.
to the mother, devastating.
Right, exactly,
right?
Exactly.
And there's that umbilical cord again, right?
Right,
yeah.
Fascinating. So one of the things that I saw in all of the work were snippets of women experiencing anxiety that didn't feel comfortable to talk about, a lot of romanticism of motherhood versus the reality, which if you're a mother, you know that you have both romanticism and reality, and some magical thinking. So in Linda's, she writes, was I making mom go mad? Most often she was calm, but when she flipped, it felt as if it were my fault. It wasn't so much what she said. It was more that she became small all of a sudden. I made her small. It was scary. I wondered whether I had to start talking again to stop her from disappearing. If I had to choose between her and myself, I would choose her. And then Helen, you write, the realization of an old fantasy of hers, to be in two places at once, to have two bodies, to give herself over to her own recovery while her children were in the hands of someone who loved them exactly as she did. And Kate, you write in one of your stories, she pictured her clearly, a single woman who hovers in the school hallway, wearing the look that Liz has come to associate with certain mothers, a mixture of doe-eyed expectancy and absolute terror, as if at any moment they might be asked to recite the Pledge of Allegiance or the current policy on plagiarism. So how does our culture romanticize motherhood, and then what do we do about the reality? How do we address that? And again, how is fiction a great place to examine it all?
Yeah. I guess the mother in this book, it was really my only chance, I guess. I didn't have anyone else than her. So to do something bad to her was very risky, I felt. And I was also very much trying to get her so happy as she could be. Yes. Because for her, everything, it was so difficult. Yes. With my the very ill and violent father, and you know, the whole setting was, I felt it was so much risk in it. So then it can also be like that you really try to put the mother into pieces again.
Yes.
Yeah.
One of the things that I found so beautiful about your book was that while Ellen doesn't speak, she's so reflective and so insightful that you really feel great hope for her.
Yeah.
That she's struggling with a lot of things, but I just felt like she was so much stronger than she thought she was, and I had great hope for her, which I think is, again, a really hard thing to portray, especially when you have a character who's not speaking, you know? Mm. So that was super, super interesting. Mm. Anyone else on the idea of romanticism versus reality?
Well, that quote that you read is from one of the stories, and it refers to a group that, again, another group. I realize my limited imagination.
You love groups.
I like the groups. This was a group in a school in New York, and I think I titled, I don't exactly remember, but I think I called it something like Staying Calm in the Age of Anxiety. And I think
there's a parenting expert I noticed in there.
Yes, there is a parenting
expert. She's on point.
She gives them, you know. But this contradiction, I mean, I remember being in New York right after 9/11, and my older daughter was in preschool at the time, and that someone very kindly sent to the preschool downtown. They sent just a whole bag of little teddy bears for the kids. And all the kids had these little teddy bears, which was lovely. But I think at the same time, you know, every time seeing that little teddy bear was a reminder of the source of the teddy bear. So I think that we're kind of all in agreement about this age of anxiety that we're living in. Mm-hmm. So that's just an example of one little detail that has not found its way yet into my fiction, but probably will at some point. Because I don't know if it's romanticism necessarily. It's just that, you know, that the realities of where we are now in our lives and in our culture, of course, seep their way into fiction. And you know, you're grappling with in your fiction, even if you're not writing from your own experience. It's coming through in these characters that we create, and again, we don't know where they're going, but you're seeing it through the scrim of your own personality and experience.
And imagining,
right. Yeah.
So I recently read an essay by a writer, Carla Bruce Eddings, and it was about how before she had a child, she was like, I'm so excited to have a child and just magically be a mom, and like, you know, because my mom just always seemed like she knew what she was doing. And the essay then follows her having a child and totally not knowing what to do and feeling more at sea than she ever has before. And so I think that there is this cultural image of motherhood that makes us think that, well, if you have a baby, then you'll just know all these things that moms know, and you'll be able to do all these things that moms do, and you'll always be strong and confident and solid. And that's not what it feels like. Like, this image of the glowing, competent, baking cookies mother is wonderful. The moments when you achieve that are a moment to celebrate, but it's just not like that much. And I think probably social media doesn't help with this, because people get to cater their lives for consumption. So, yes, so I'm interested in, I actually think that if you acknowledge the glowing moments where you actually manage to get it right and all of the like 80% of the time where you're fumbling and messing up and not knowing quite what to do, I think it's richer if we can acknowledge all of that. But I think it's, but we don't. And I think that I find all the mommy wars where people are having different perspectives on little things about like how to do sleep training or stuff, I find it sad, and I feel like we're all scared and anxious and trying to figure it out. And a lot of that tension or staking out a position comes from maybe an anxiety that we is actually a shared thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also our own identities to be how we are, you know, like you said, the social media, how you curate your persona. It's the idea that even if you're struggling, you'd want other people to think that it's all joyful abundance, right? Mm-hmm. And that you're not struggling. And why? Because everyone does. Why do we feel we need to own that or claim that? It's just, and it's just gone on and on and on for years and years.
Yeah.
I also found that we saw the same romanticism and ambivalence when we were talking about romantic relationships. So Kate, in a beautiful story called Paris 1994, you write, "Rebecca looks away. There is something too perfect about it, the scene. It is what they all wanted, isn't it? Marion, Rebecca, Sophie. The something someone else had, the scene through a frame, to be a black-haired woman to eat a ripe pear." And Helen, you write, "Molly and David had this thing they say to one another, 'I love you even though I hate you.' Molly says, 'Sometimes you had to hate the person who is using the toilet or taking a shower or at work or sleeping or doing any other indulgent thing while you were caught in the cyclones of your children's needs.'" So again, we see the romanticism versus the reality there. We're in Paris. We're supposed to be, it's supposed to be wonderful.
Well, what happened?
Which it is. Paris is wonderful.
Paris, right? I mean, how can you not in Paris?
But your character is having ambivalence about becoming pregnant in that story and what their relationship will be like.
Right.
And then your character is talking about the reality of sort of, you know, resenting someone who gets to sleep. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yes.
Which is so, which is,
shower.
But again, both of those things are true.
Yes. No one can identify with that.
I'm sure. Yeah, no. No. Yeah. I think that in my book, the couple has some kind of dark jokes like that running throughout. Because they say that to each other, and it's sincere but tender at the same time, or at least giving a name like, "I love you even though I hate you because you're taking a shower," you know. I think that without a sense of humor, black humor, it's very hard for a relationship to thrive in the early childhood years. So I recommend black humor.
Yeah, without question. And then finally, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I just read something that apparently the French, speaking of the French, there's a phrase, Anglo-Saxon humor, which means something being funny but not funny at the same time. I just love that. And I just learned.
There's a lot of that, right?
Yeah, exactly.
There's a lot of that.
Funny
yeah.
and not funny.
Yeah. And then I was going to say, finally, before we open it up to questions, this romanticism versus reality impacts work as well. And so, Linda, you talk about Ellen's portrayal of her mother and her real need for the theater and what the theater really does for her identity and how it makes her cope. And that the brightness of her work is powerful, and yet the children, or at least Ellen, feels sometimes that she's choosing that over being with her. And Helen, you say that when Molly's in the pit, which is where she works as a archaeologist, that she sometimes...
Paleobotanist. Yes.
that she sometimes forgets she's a mother. Mm-hmm. So when she's in work, when she's in flow, she forgets that she's a mother. And then Kate, in Radical Feminist, a fantastic closing story of your collection, Beatrice fantasizes about putting her former boss on trial because he cavalierly linked her possible pregnancy with a promotion that she was seeking. So how does this romantic versus reality come into play in the work world? And in 2019, why are we still having this conversation about women having to choose between those desires?
Hmm. Yeah. Well, in Radical Feminists, the character Beatrice has had an experience where she's up for a big promotion. And she sits in the boss's office, And the boss says to her, I could get sued for saying this, but you're not planning on getting pregnant anytime soon, are you? And she, in fact, is in the midst of, you know, a fabulous time with her husband trying to get pregnant. And so she has various revenge fantasies about what she's going to say if she ever... She ends up pulling her name from consideration because she feels as if she can't go forward, and yet at the same time, she knows that there's really nothing she can do about it. Because it's publishing, and her name will be, she'll never advance.
And I love what her mother says to her. It's like,
actually, what her mother says is, "Well, are you planning on getting pregnant?" Her mother wants to know. and so she has these revenge fantasies, and then what happens is she accidentally bumps many years later, when she has two sons and she's in the middle of a busy place in New York, she accidentally bumps into this boss, and so she's it's a little fantastic in the fiction use of the word, in the sense that you don't know whether she's actually saying these things to this man or not, but she's right. Not.
But I loved everything she said, yeah, or didn't.
I wish that she actually could have had.
Exactly.
I
deserved it.
I would have liked to have written it that way. You know, I would have liked to have given her moment. And that's a little bit speaks to what I said earlier. I mean, I would have liked to do that for her, but that didn't feel true to the story somehow. What felt true to the story was that she was kind of locked in this, you know, if only, if only, if only, and was left very happily in the end skating in Bryant Park with her two sons, thinking, well, there'll be another time. There'll be another moment when I'll get my right. due. But right. that's how she felt true to me. That's how it felt true. And by truth, I mean truth within the fictional world of the story, even though I did want to put him on trial.
Yes, I did as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that was the case in when my mother was in the theater at that age. That was really, the babies were a huge threat to the whole productions.
Yeah. Yes.
And yeah, so it was like a lot of that talk. No babies now, okay?
That's right.
Yeah? Yeah. So because everyone, it's a big production, everyone are yes. depending on each other.
Well, and we just recently had a conversation in the media about Elizabeth Warren.
Right.
Being told, you know, she said that the job was hers and then it wasn't hers, and people saying, well, she wasn't really fired. It's like, well, any woman knows that yes, in fact, her job was taken away from her, and it was because of that. And that still continues. And then, you know, on Twitter, there was this whole string of people talking about their stories of losing their work because of their choice of motherhood. So we're still here.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, in The Need, Molly's identity as a scientist, as a paleobotanist, is so important to her, and so is her identity as a mother, and they both enrich each other. And so I think that can get a little bit lost in the conversation, maybe, that there's a lot of joy in the ability to continue your work when you have children. There's a lot of joy in the ability to have multiple identities. And my book is very much about the friction of navigating that, but Molly wouldn't choose something other than continuing to pursue
to
these deep questions. And I mean, it's certainly terrible if someone is literally in a situation where they get fired because they're pregnant, and that shouldn't happen. But in my book, I'm more exploring what do you do when you do have the job and you do have the family, and how do you... There's not an easy answer there, because when you're doing a profession you love and when you have a family, there's going to be a lot demanded of you intellectually and emotionally and physically and time-wise. So I don't really have a solution.
Right.
I don't know.
And I'm not sure there is one. If anyone went to the keynote last night by Samantha Powers, she spoke of this notion of being this UN ambassador and being a close advisor to President Obama and also having two little children. And I started her book last night, and it's remarkable. So in whether we do this in fiction or nonfiction or dialogues like this one, it's definitely something we want to continue to discuss. We'd love to have questions from you about the books, about the topics, about the themes, about writing, whatever suits your fancy. And if you could just come up to the center mic, that would be great. We can keep talking forever, but yes. If you have a nice loud voice, you can stay right there.
Oh. Okay. Just because no one else had a question, I just was wanting to comment. So I'm 73 years old, lived through the feminist period, has dealt with everything in the workplace, and so there is no answer. So I was also an executive coach for women in leadership. There absolutely is no answer. You have to find it and your balance yourself, and sometimes you're going to be more balanced than other times. And just understanding that kind of ebb and flow of combining work and motherhood, standing up. And then just one other point as an older woman. Your motherhood never goes away. So now I'm a grandmother and I have two kids. And so now I have two more people to give me anxiety.
I just became a grandmother, so I can attest to that. Now there's another person that I love with all my heart, and it's both joyful abundance and right. Yeah. Any other questions? Yes.
Thank you very much. I wonder if you could comment about being a mother and being a writer, and how motherhood has affected your writing. Because as you know, it's really hard. I'm a new mother, I have a young son, and I'm also a writer, and I just find it very difficult to negotiate those two identities. Not to say anything bad about any other profession, but when you're a writer, there's something particularly, all-consuming about it. And so I wonder if you could address that.
Sure. Does anybody want to jump in on motherhood and writing?
Yeah. Well, I'll say one thing, which is, I don't know how old your children are, or your child is, but once they get to the age where they're reading Harry Potter, or they're loving Harry Potter, there's always the J.K. Rowling. Where would we be if J.K. Rowling didn't take the time to write? It's just a good line to have in your back pocket.
I have a toddler, by the way.
Oh, well, you'll get there soon enough. You're not there yet, right?
Do you want to go first?
Yeah. I thought in a way it went easier when I was a little bit older, having children to write, because I valued this little time so much. So I think it. But of course, you need a time, space for a long time. And the times was so much more important. So when you had time, it was joyful and you could concentrate
And it's holding that as a sacred space, for that work.
Yeah.
To add to that, I do feel like, yes, you become you have to become so efficient in every way. And for me, that extended to my writing life as well. Because if you are, say, literally paying someone to take care of your child and you're paying them by the hour, you can make the most of an hour in a way that you wouldn't have maybe done so before. So before I had children, I was able to wake up early in the morning and write for 3 or 4 hours a day. And since having children, depending on my schedule, but often it's only 1 hour a day. So I set a timer. It's kind of a small thing, but it really helps me set a timer for 1 hour or even 45 minutes, whatever amount of time I have, and really close the doors of my mind to everything else for that brief period of time and just focus completely. And I've ended up feeling like I believe that my best writing has been done since I had children. And So I feel like the energy of that 3 or 4 hours had to get compressed into 45 minutes or an hour, and there's actually something positive about that. I mean, I never leave a writing day feeling like I've done enough, but that's a good energy to carry into the next day. And though I feel like my children, in a sense, are the biggest impediment to my writing because of the time issue, they're also the biggest inspiration I've ever had for my writing. I mean, the sense of urgency that it has given me, the sense of depth and the existential questions it's raised for me, it's really fruitful at the same time. So I know it's hard, but there's some benefits.
There are a lot.
I mean, the other thing is that it also, I think having children, you get out in the world a little bit more. And I think that there's a way when you're writing sort of before, you can get very insular. One can get very insular, right? But that can't be anymore. You're out in the world. It's about something bigger than you, right? And so just to kind of piggyback on what Linda and Helen said.
And I would also say being out in the world looking for inspiration and material, right? I mean, overhearing dialogue and looking at the way people interact with one another or the way they're dressed or the way they move. That's all material. Mm-hmm. So you're looking, too, to be out in the world, and you can count that as writing time, right? The time that you're driving and the radio's off and you're going to pick somebody up but nobody's in the car yet, that can be space where you're working a story or you're imagining what you're going to write when you get to the desk. Mm-hmm. So use those little snippets of time. Yeah. Snippets, writing in snippets.
Right.
Any other questions? Yes.
Oh, and so there's a lot of preconceived notions of what a good mother is. But when I talk to my European friends about this, they find this very interesting in the sense that they seem to have a much more mature outlook on parenting at large, in the sense that there's a much more kind of holistic, you're going to have good days and you're going to have bad days. And it's a much more long-term view. So I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts on that.
Yes. I have not myself experienced, I haven't talked to so many people about this when I have been here, but I think Sweden is perhaps a dream country for having children because of the society, actually. So you have this, it's many, many good politics around this. And it is. Like free childcare when you are working in the daytime. And you got, it's, I think it's very much helpful and makes that the period of, you don't have to stress that much, I think, yeah. But of course, the feelings are always the same. Yeah.
Right, yeah. Right. So the feelings are the same, but at least the support feels like there's respect for the work.
Yeah, a little bit, maybe. Yeah. Yeah, I guess it is. It's been worked. I mean, they have worked very, very hard and long to get this system as we have about being home with children. And we also have this... the fathers must be home too.
Right.
Yes. So
interesting.
Yeah.
Did you have a question?
Oh, yes. I also had a question for Linda, and it relates to your book. I haven't read your book yet, but the way you described it reminded me a little bit of the film Persona, with the two characters, one of whom speaks quite a lot, and then the other one who refuses to speak.
Yeah.
And I just wondered, were you influenced by that film, or are you inspired by Bergman? How do you feel being part of this Scandinavian, tradition?
I'm definitely inspired by Bergman, for sure. Yeah. I think I've seen all his films, and his films has meant a lot to me. And I think a little bit mixed, this persona, this woman, she is a grown-up who doesn't speak, and Ellen is a child, so I think there is some difference. Yeah, yeah, but absolutely. I think I've been very inspired by theater as well. So I always think that I'm looking for a stage somewhere in the novel, yeah. And I think in this one, the apartment is the stage, yeah.
Yes, yeah. Yes, I see that now, as you mention it.
Yeah.
Yes.
I have a question for Helen. Mm-hmm. I really, really enjoyed your book. And
thank you.
I was actually introduced to your story, The Knowers, in a class I took as a grad student. And I have a right question now.
Okay. And your thoughts are prepared.
But I take, I know you mentioned that this book is, you know, speculative fiction or sci-fi, mm-hmm. And I absolutely get those, the vibe from a lot of the themes. But I take a lot of your themes and, like, can still apply them to everyday life, mm-hmm. or to, like, kind of the world around us, even if it is this kind of, like, alternate reality. Even though my classmates would relate it to maybe, like, Black Mirror, which, mm-hmm. like, I kind of felt was, like, a little too campy, like, of a comparison. But I guess I'm wondering if you feel like writing speculative fiction and sci-fi, like, leaves too much room for some sort of, like, falsification or criticism, like, for people to kind of, like, take from the work too much.
Yeah, I mean, I think these questions of genre are really interesting for me because, as you say, in a story like The Knowers, there is a, you could say, a sci-fi or speculative conceit in that, which is that you can, if you choose, you can go to an ATM machine and put in your social security number, and the ATM machine will tell you the date of your death. And so in a couple, member of the couple chooses to do this and one doesn't. So she lives the story knowing the date of her death. However, I would like to point out that all of us, though we don't know the date, we do know that death is coming. So I just, by having that conceit, it puts a particular point on it, but it's the same human condition that we're in. So a lot of times when I'm using a science fiction conceit, it is very moored in what actual human experience is. And certainly in The Need, I didn't think, oh, I want to write a speculative novel so much. I more felt like, okay, in order for this woman to, in order for me to explore the questions that I want to explore, I have to have the perfect nemesis arise out of the cosmic void. That's the only way to get at the themes. So I use genre to enable me to ask the questions that I want to ask. So I would probably be closer to you than to your classmates. Though I love Black Mirror, and I love that. I mean, sometimes they're a little too bloody for me, actually, but I think those are fascinating stories. But I'm interested in real life and using genre to get at real life.
Yes. Great.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
In my work, I see so many children and families that I try to do more take pieces. And in my own fiction, I don't use my children as models. I almost feel like I want to push myself more to not do that, but that's just a choice. Though my children will tell you that they see themselves everywhere in my work. So maybe they are as well, I don't know. But it's funny, it's, you know, and I think that's true really with anyone who writes fiction. People are certain that a character is themselves when in fact that wasn't what your inspiration was.
Yes.
But did you have a thought?
Well, I feel as if I take really minor things, if things at all, by a detail it might be, you know, just somebody wearing a certain kind of shoe, because that's the popular shoe at the time. I always feel as if my characters are are coming from a completely different place. Mm-hmm. So it's not, I'm not thinking through, oh, that happened to this person I know, I want to use that. Because it's that old thing of when you're in a situation, I've had this happen where you think, oh, that's a great story, I'm going to write that story. And then you try to write that story, and if it's a real story, it just falls flat on the page. It never feels as if it has any life. So I think that's something that I felt very early on when I started writing, because when I started writing, I would take stories and think, okay, I'm going to write that story because it's a good one. And then I realized, no, that's not the way to get at it. And so from very early on, I don't really take stories or anything that's true. It's just that.
But maybe a seed of it.
Well, a seed, but it's always a very, it's a poppy seed. I don't know, it's a sesame seed. Well, I mean, what do you guys say to that?
I try to be. I don't want my children to see themselves in any characters. But probably they do anyway.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. I change names, and I think I try to be so, I don't want to write about them, but sometimes I do anyway.
Right. Mm.
I think part of the reason I'm drawn to genre is because it makes me feel a little more protected, because it really is set in an alternate world. So I feel like I can... There are certain lines of dialogue that do come from my own life. Sometimes there are lines that literally come from my own life. But the sci-fi and thriller context makes me feel a little protected in that way. Maybe I'll mark my words, but I have no interest in ever writing a memoir, say, about my family or children. That would feel very exposing and vulnerable to me. And even writing about motherhood as much as I do feels very exposing and vulnerable to me. But I do... I feel like the genre helps me with that. And one thing that's so interesting is, since my book came out, people will write to me and say, were you eavesdropping on my conversation with my child? Because there is, I don't know, it's touching to me that some specific thing that comes from my own life actually feels, in its specificity, rather universal.
Yeah. I think the themes, you talk about character, but I think it's interesting more that themes come from our lives, and the vulnerability is in, I'm writing about this theme, mm-hmm. or I'm talking about this perspective on the world. So I think for some it might be character that feels like you're making yourself vulnerable, but I think in a lot of ways it can really be the topics that you're writing about and your insight into that. When you're, regardless of what you're writing, when people read it, they know there's, you are behind that. So, obviously they're going to make connections to your own thoughts and opinions, perspectives, and so on. So, mm-hmm. Yes?
I was just going to say what a service it is that people write about motherhood. So inside, that it's not portrayed that often, and it's ambivalence, it's weirdness, mm-hmm. how we call it. And how fascinating it is that people very rarely identify with the mother. It's usually the kid that's neglected, or mm-hmm. most stories are about the abandoned child or whatever. And there's the people who come to look at who's the mother. Mm-hmm. So it's just wonderful.
I think we're going to see more and more. I think that there's a way in which you're seeing in fiction more fully human women.
Mm. Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah.
The whole range.
I mean, I think everyone can, you can always think of things that your parents did wrong. And we can all hold those grudges. But since becoming a parent, I just think, gosh, there's so many moments you confront where you're like, I don't know the right thing to do. I want to do the right thing right now. I want to be the right person right now. And I don't know how. So bumping up against your own vulnerability is a big part of the experience.
It
so
it
helps to acknowledge that,
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you all for coming. I do invite you to please visit the independent bookstore table and enjoy these wonderful selections. And thank you for joining us today.
Thanks.